Devil, then, and because we can't, now that we've arrived at that doorway, I don't think we can turn away. I mean, you said you on this podcast I listened to yesterday, it was about well, you made a correspondence similar to the one I just made between researching conspiratorial elements of existence with studying the nature of evil. And you said that the human mind was not capable of
contemplating evil.
Contemplating, thank you, evil. Which
I don't.
Well, I found that as interesting as a, I guess, as a challenge. I would say that, well, this is an interesting paradox. Also, I guess I find everything interesting. I should stop using that word. There's a paradox there, because I don't use the word evil as a descriptor. I will use the word because people talk about evil and they use it, so I'll talk about it in that meta sense, as in what do people mean when they say evil. But I don't use it personally, certainly not as a noun, possibly as an adjective once in a while. If so, I tend to use it in a jokey way, like some movie I saw was evil or what have you, because it's an absolutist term, right? So, and I try to stay away from absolutist terms. But on the other hand, paradox is that I would say that you know, most of my writing and now podcasting has been directed towards contemplating the nature of evil, essentially, which is the human capacity for delusion, for darkness, for I could give you a whole bunch of synonyms. I could tell you what I think evil is, but actually what occurred to me today, knowing I was going to talk to you, is that what I'm exploring, what I hope I'm exploring, is the root cause of evil, which I imagine is, I mean, for a Catholic, it's the devil. But then, at least for a secular person, I don't know if I'm secular, but I'm certainly non-Christian. The question then is, what's the root cause of the devil? Like, where did the devil come from? Now, I'm not going to ask you that question because I know that you can't answer it. But I guess, what do I want to say here? What we were talking about earlier, or I was rather, about how delusion, well, you touched on it, how delusion can become real if we go all the way into it. I forget the exact words that you used. And I answered by saying about how whole systems of belief and correspondences can be generated over time by human beings if they persist in belief, which is a little bit close to, of course, you know, Keckism and chaos magic and whatnot, but whatever the case, I think there's plenty of evidence for this. You know, if people believe something for long enough and that then they act on it, then it assumes a certain kind of reality, if only internally in their own minds, in the way that they perceive reality. So that is my sense about the devil, that there is something, I mean, there is a metaphysical dimension to our existence, and it's the greater one, because it not corresponds with, but it leads into the eternal, what is eternal. And we could say the soul. I mean, you and I might agree about that. I do suspect there is such thing as an eternal soul, forgot what I was saying, actually. What was I saying? The metaphysical, right? So there is a metaphysical dimension to human experience, and that includes, you know, the worst aspects. So, you know, evil acts of evil, destructive acts, and that there is I mean, like I have encountered, admittedly, in dreams and, on drugs, so I don't necessarily trust, I certainly don't trust the drug experiences, but the dream ones I might trust more. I would say I've encountered a presence or a force or intelligence that would be very easy to assume was the devil, and I'm pretty sure that if I were to encounter it now, I would be convinced that it was the devil, but I don't actually believe that. Like, I think that there is another way to see that and understand it. And what I'm getting to, if this is, I don't know what it is, a question or just a proposition, that devil and God, that's a dichotomy. Well, and if I'm going to go with that, then I have to see that the devil came after God. So for me, my understanding of evil is fragmentation, and my understanding of good is wholeness. And by that definition, evil only exists as a fragment. And when wholeness is achieved, then that's it. And before fragmentation occurs, that's also it. That there is no evil. Now, I don't want this to be a platitude or anything. I'm hoping to describe something that's experiential. Like I do experience my own capacity for evil, and I know that it's there, and I do experience this metaphysical dimension to evil, and of course I research evil on a daily basis, or what anyone else pretty much would consider to be evil. But I still feel like the universe or existence, reality, is all one. Yeah, I didn't want to end on a platitude, but that there is a wholeness, there is an integrity to existence, and for a Catholic, that would be God, that would be the divine. Anyway, it's getting very philosophical, but I guess, as with David, when I was talking to David, like there's so much agreement there, and then there's this basic. It doesn't have to be a disagreement because we don't have to disagree, but it's a very divergent perspective. So I just, yeah, go ahead.
Well, to say that I don't know, that evil is a privation of good, or falling apart of the from the whole, that's pretty much sound metaphysical description of theology of devil. I would say that's not superficial at all. But what you mentioned, that I said that human mind cannot contemplate evil. I didn't mean cannot research. I meant cannot contemplate, and contemplate would mean to grasp its essence. And in grasping the essence of a thing, a mind becomes the thing. This is, I think, that this is not in nature of human mind, because the nature of human mind is to look for good. And one sign of this you can see in people who are historical personages who were considered to be evil. And when you look at their tastes, what they like, what music they liked, what movies they watched, what books they read, they were not, for instance, they were watching a movie, rooting for a good guy, and so on and so forth.
Right.
That's one illustration. I haven't met a lot of real evil people, two or three maybe in my life, but their communication with other people is in the guise of good, because and what I want to say, nobody will come look you in the eyes and say, "I want to do injustice because I love injustice. I love to tear the to rape a small prepubescent child and then tear him limb to limb." This is something you just don't meet, although you have people who will do something like that in the war or in such a situation, and they'll suffer. Most of them will suffer from post-traumatic disorder afterwards, because their conscience will start to torture them. Some won't, but those are, in my opinion and in my experience, rather rare. And that podcast you mentioned was based on experience one my friend had, who was researching this Franklin cover-up, famous pedophile case. And what happened to him I know what happened to him. He was researching, and then he started to contemplate. He had, in the middle of the night, he had a vision of what he is getting into. And he was completely emotionally and even physically devastated for days. Because there is obviously something in us, not only in mind, but we are talking about mind, but, so I'll stick to that, in our thinking, in our mentality, that really cannot contemplate evil in condensed form. We started this conversation with Bataille and radical ideas from people like Bataille, who then infiltrate, for instance, hypothetically, mainstream society. Now we can ask ourselves, why do they have to infiltrate it? And they always did have to infiltrate it. No matter how bad society was, you just couldn't come up with an idea that enlightenment can be gained only through trauma. Through trauma is a septic word. He would have to say you can have enlightenment only by picking your eyes out or I don't know, beating somebody to a pulp and laughing about it. And then we come full circle. It is obvious at least it is obvious to me, and I think it can be demonstrated, that the normal state of man's intellect and will and emotionality is always directed towards to the opposite of evil. And that's why but it is not conscious, it is not very intense, people. We are all weak, and so on and so forth. But I think evil is very good to prove the existence of good, because it simply you see that the good, the necessity of the existence of good, because evil is a parasite. It's a parasitic existence. To give you an example, when somebody say that, to get back to this Bataille's idea of traumatizing yourself to enlightenment, this idea could not dawn on him. This is my opinion. If there wasn't idea of enlightenment through ascent, through moral purification or intellectual or spiritual, he just took the opposite of something already existing. And this is, in my opinion, parasitical idea. Although people like that guy, who was, I think, from what I saw, he had this authentic evil bent. They believe that they are touching to something primordial, something that is that the real nature of man is grasped when you turn your gaze below, not above. Not try to ascend, but try to descend. And this is the core. Now we have come full circle, because this is what I meant. For instance, in that podcast you mentioned at the beginning, and this is the idea. This is the nexus of ideas I research. These directions of up and down. Can you judge an idea by the way where it directs your focus, you know, and so on. I hope I made sense with this.
It does.
A bit abstract.
It does. I mean, and part of what I described as my lifelong interest or will to immerse in darkness, as a researcher, is that, or let's say that. In recent years, I've begun to understand that fixation better as a need to go down before I can go up. So the obvious metaphor is of a tree, that it has to put those roots in. It can't start growing until the roots go in. Now, that's a romantic metaphor. I'm not a tree.
Okay. No, I think it's an apt metaphor. It's a perfectly fine and natural thing, I think, to think this way.
Yeah.
What I was talking about were people who don't want to put roots in the ground. Those are people who want to dig the ground and to kind of to dig into matter, into mud of matter completely, with no spirit, and then dissolve the matter itself. To come to nothing, to come to opposite of what is highest. And this is the way of thinking. This is satanism. This is, I would say, philosophical satanism, because satanism proper, in my opinion, is regularly tied with religion. So you have, for instance, at least in theory, satanic mass is performed by some defrocked Catholic or maybe Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox priest, somebody who was consecrated and now he is desecrating. This philosophical Satanism, you don't need no church for that. And for instance, those Order of Nine Angles ideas are precisely most radical expression of this, what I'm talking about. Because this is the idea of reaching the acausal. An acausal realm would be that which is not pure, which is pure chaos. In fact, there is no causal relations, and out of that manifests the causal world. And they always strive to go to the acausal because they see it as an infinite power. It is unbridled by anything else. There is no causal chains where something is bigger or smaller. This is complete darkness. And I think this idea, this orientation towards below is very, very pronounced, even in mainstream Western societies with teachings like Darwinism, with even with Marxism, especially in its radical forms, this idea that you have to, in some way, found the lowest common denominator of man and reduce man to practically material being. But what is interesting is that they go, not Marxist, but this Sotonist in the vein of, I think Bataille was one of them. I'm not sure, but for instance, David Mayat, Order of the Nine Angles, Alexander Dugin, they definitely, and they usually define themselves as a left-hand path. And this is their objective, to grasp into absolute below, that is absolute opposite of light, causality, beauty, truth. They see truth in that. And for instance, you have mainstream philosophers like Martin Heidegger, who is extremely influential in academia in the West. Not in Britain. He never gained ground with your countrymen for some reason, but in continental Europe and America, Heidegger is still one of the most influential thinkers of 20th century. Heidegger's philosophy is completely this thing I'm talking about.
But well disguised, I think. Or I don't know about well, but
Yes.
disguised anyway.
Yes, I don't know if have you ever read him, but he's very difficult. He's especially if you are Anglophone, it's very, very hard to understand him.
I haven't read him, but I got a. I think I shoplifted, I'm glad to say, a copy for my sister because she was studying existential psychology and it was on her reading list. So, and so it is. He is somewhat influential in Britain even. And she seemed to, I think she did say it was hard to understand, but I think she also got things from it that she found, you know, positive and benevolent. So recently I've been talking to somebody who's very down on Heidegger, Gary Haidt, and so he's kind of introduced me to the perspective that you have on Heidegger there. But I
Well,
wanted to, yeah. Go ahead.
please continue. I'll always
No,
interrupt.
I wanted to go back to Bataille, and this whole downward thing, 'cause, and the left-hand path, and you know, 'cause I was on the left-hand path for a long time. I did a lot of drugs and doing well. Actually, I did actually end up doing things I didn't even realize I was doing, but I can't just sum them up too quickly because they'd need context. But you know, it was nothing too horrific, and it's nothing I wouldn't talk about. But anyway, I was on the left-hand path as a magician or occultist. I didn't do ritual magic much, but basically, I understood it partially as, you know, a lead up for the right-hand path. First you do the left hand, that's in Castaneda. First you got to learn about the dark arts, and then you move on, and etc. So, you know, my point of view now is neither the left hand or the right-hand path is any good. I don't see them as, you know, one good, one bad. I see them as two sides of the same thing. And I would say the same about this upward and downward thing. I mean, this is my experience. I'm not necessarily addressing what you perceive, just what you said, that it's to do with the will to power. And there's, yes, the people who are going downward, they're driven by the will to power, but then so are the people who, many of the people who are seemingly aspiring upward, or at least espousing the values about, you know, upward values. This is what I was saying about the weird conflation or congruence between not just left and right, but nihilism and spirituality, or whatever we would say is the apparent opposite of nihilism, that they're actually bedfellows. Like the will to power will use whatever it has to. And so, specifically bringing back to the specifics, that Jeffrey Kripal, the thing that this article he wrote about Bataille, what I do remember, one of the things I really zeroed in on that first chapter of Prison of Infinity, was he used the example of the Hearn, the Hadron Collider, and how it was necessary to smash matter to get, you know, to the smallest particle in order to discover, you know, the true nature of existence. So he was using examples of how violence is necessary in order to attain truth and enlightenment, which is exactly what I was confronting him about, and exactly what you're zeroing in on there, from the scientific
Absolutely.
perspective.
Digele čašu, spustil je nebo, videl ju je, zato je lima čisto srce.
Yes.
Yeah.
You so. Have this in post-humanism. This is definitely the same idea in many forms. I would agree completely on this.
Yeah. So, and one correspondence I make, or the correspondence I made in Prisoner Infinity was between this, what Kripal was advocating, in this, you know, seemingly benign, culturally progressive disguise, because it's science, right? And they're just atoms, so who, you know, mm-hmm. it's innocuous violence. But on the other hand, he's promoting somebody like Whitley Strieber, who was a victim of MK Ultra, who was psychically traumatized as an infant, raped and tortured, and who knows what exactly, because he doesn't remember it, and that allowed him to access these dissociative realms in which he supposedly had an experience of the visitors, and you know that led to this massive industry of alien abduction literature. So mm-hmm. the obvious correspondence there between smashing matter with a Hadron Collider and hacking into the psyche through trauma, through violence, through ritualized, organized abuse of children. And I think that's what you're touching on, where the attempt is to access this acausal realm where mm-hmm. It's possible to shape reality. I mean, it's not reality, but it creates a surrogate of reality, it seems. I mean, that seems to be, I don't want to say the goal, but that seems to be part of what you're describing, I think.
Yes, I think it's a will to recreate a reality at will, because I think the real motive in this breaking apart atoms, for instance, which is, by the way, a pretty mainstream way of thinking, come to think of it.
Yeah.
And this, for instance, in Order of the Nine Angles, when they mentally and by some exercises and by political terrorism, they want to bring about, to invoke chaos, is an attempt to remodel society, to remodel oneself, because you break, idea is that you have to break everything up and then remold it at will, and you are some kind of... Some kind of pure ego, because this is the philosophy of ego, pure egoism,
yeah.
And isolation,
right.
And aspiring towards upwards, traditionally, not only in revealed religions, but in pagan metaphysics as Neoplatonism, which is, in my opinion, a proper compendium of ancient Greek philosophy. The idea never was that going upwards means that you are climbing upwards, but that which abodes upwards gives you an act of mercy. This is even in philosophy, for instance, in Platonic philosophy, the knowledge of this higher... higher and at the same time more sublime and more interior reality is a gift bestowed upon thinker who is mentally focused on this, who is doing a kind of mental prayer, one could say. My point is that by going this road, you have to renounce idea that you as a human being will ever be at the top of creation, that you will ever be anything else than you already are. You will be uplifted, you will be better, and you will be loved, for instance, not by your own efforts. You can't accomplish this. You are always under something which is better than you, but better in every sense, not primarily in a sense of power, but in a sense of love, for instance, mm-hmm. a sense of intellect in Platonism. Whereas these guys, these modern Satanists, because they are very modern, this is very modern outlook, by going into this acousal, are doing opposites. They are trying to deify themselves, in fact, I would say.
Yeah.
Posthumanism is posthumanism. For instance, this what's his name? That famous Google engineer now, Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah,
he's a typical example of that pitiful postmodern God. He wants to be God. He wants to store all of his memories on hard disks or something, because of course his memory is failing him as he's getting old, and he probably doesn't want to let go. And the only I remember reading his Singularity is Near book, and it is patently obvious from that book that man is so horrified of dying,
mm-hmm.
that he cannot imagine a world without himself, and he cannot cope with losing power and control. And this is terrible. This is really 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 a most in my perspective the most degrading idea that man ever came up with, this techno posthumanism, this idea of turning people into cyborgs and robots.
Yeah, I would agree. It's ironically, I'm actually talking to a transhuman advocate tomorrow. Not exactly looking forward to it, but as a case study, I mean, it's quite hard to find one that it's possible to have a conversation with, because I think it's so mm-hmm. profoundly disconnected from reality.
Yes, yes, precisely. You can't relate to them.
No, and yeah. it's very difficult to know what kind of language to use or what to refer to refute a delusion of that sort. Mm-hmm. And it has to be experiential, of course. And I mean, I can look at my own trajectory, and although I was never so mentally deluded, if that's not tautology, that's probably tautology, isn't it? But anyway, I was never so deluded to believe in something like transhumanism. I was very, very deluded enough to know, I mean, I can see it enough now to know that I must probably still be pretty deluded today as well, you know, but at least I can see that, you know, to some extent the delusion I was in back then. And mm-hmm. my journey from out of delusion, which is not complete, needless to say, but has gone on long enough that I can at least see a course that I've been on, very much has been out of the mind and into the body. So for me, it's interesting, because we've been talking about the mind quite a lot, and you're saying how the mind can't contemplate evil, and I don't know if I disagree or I don't know what I think about that, except that I think that the mind essentially can't really contemplate anything in a way. I mean, like it can't. It's interesting you said that. How about if it really contemplates something, it becomes identified with it. It becomes it. But anyway, I'm not sure if I have anything to say about that. But there's something I said to my brother when he was alive. He died in 2010. I've written about him. And he was you could say he was a Satanist, although he turned it into mm-hmm. a joke, and he was not a religious, but he was a bit of a pioneer, you could say, or a prototype of this, the new kind of neoliberal Satanist, or I don't know if I should even call it that, because as you point out, it's left and right, but anyway, the secular Satanist. Anyway, I said to him that it's not death of the body that's frightening, it's death of the mind. And he understood and he agreed about that. And talking to you now, what occurs to me is that the body isn't afraid of dying unless it's confronted with something in nature that might kill it. Then it, of course, it has adrenaline to mm-hmm. you know, fuel it to make its escape. But in terms of a reality in the future, the body doesn't care less. And in terms of when it's actually happening, if there's nothing the body can do anymore, nothing we can do anymore, then the body, I believe, just relaxes. I remember Livingston, not David, the other, well, actually it is David Livingston, mm-hmm. but the other one, the famous one,
yeah,
he was attacked by a lion, and he said that he was in the jaws of the lion, and his body just became completely relaxed, and it was almost a euphoric experience. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes sense to me that the body, once it can no longer defy death, surrenders, submits to it. And there isn't, we're not programmed to fear death, I don't think, not by nature. I think we're programmed by culture, if that's not another tautology, because culture is a kind of programming. But anyway, we've been encultured in such a way that we've been able to create a separate existence. In this sense, I guess we're all Satanists living in an acausal realm, you know, of our mental, cultured, constructed self, which not only can fear death, but it's almost made of a fear of death. Like, you know, everything that we believe in and create as mental distractions and pursuits and all the rest of it, seems to me that it's largely geared as a buffer against the idea of death. So in this sense, I wrote about Ray Kurzweil in Prisoner Infinity, even though I find it so distasteful even to read anything he says, you know, I just cannot relate. But I can relate to fear, you know, the fear of fear of death. I do experience that on a daily basis, just thinking about it. So anyway, this is not leading necessarily to an opening for you, but I guess that the desire to transcend, and the desire to create this perfect ego, that seems to be a desire simply to transcend the body. I mean, obviously to transcend death, but to transcend physicality. And I think you were saying, at least I would say this, that we can't transcend physicality.
Yes.
Some stuff.
It is part of us. We can't transcend, at least by our own efforts, our finitude.
Yeah.
We are finite. And I think those people like Kurzweil, and I agree, it is a very distasteful idea. He's trying to transcend the body by more perfect body, more coarse body, to make it eternal in the chrome and metal. Yeah. This is unbelievably crude, barbarous, even to even come to this idea.
Yeah.
So that's why I consider posthumanism to be probably the most depraved idea current now.
Well, but they have. I mean, again, like I was saying about Keck and that whole audience cult. These transhumanists, they do have a lot of raw material for their fantasy, because I imagine that, you know, my transhumanist friend would answer that by saying, no, I'm going to become the cloud, you know, and that's non-physical. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea that actually we're using technology to transcend technology, that we're tapping into the metaphysical realm through these physical means, which I think there is some truth in that. But the problem is that, I'm not sure how to sum up the problem. I think you already did. Like, we can't do it by our own effort. Mm-hmm. So all we're going to do is we're creating hell, I think, essentially. Like, the more effective we can be in terms of transcending the physicality, the more disembodied we become, the more lost we're going to be.
Yes. Although I do think that posthumanism, it's more like artistic intellectual movement. They do have some inroads in politics and so on, but I don't think that anything will come out of it eventually. I wouldn't like to go into that. This is a broad subject. For instance, I subsume in posthumanism many things, not only this avant-garde posthumanists who believe in this merging with machines. I consider, for instance, alt-right in many senses posthumanist, because, for instance, they are supposed traditionalists and they believe that they can imagine Donald Trump into presidential office by using internet. Yeah. That's also posthumanist to me. Yeah. And they don't dream about merging with machines, at least not all of them. They have some specimens promoting this idea. But I think it is a really extremely depraved system of thought. And what you said earlier, it is very hard to relate to those people, and this is only the sign of the isolation into which they are putting themselves by this idea, because this is idea of complete isolation and egoism. So I'm sorry, I can apologize to all posthumanists listening to this. I can't find nice words for them.
I don't think I have any posthumanist listeners. That would be very strange. Well, I have this one who I'm speaking to tomorrow, and I have to ask him, like, why do you even like what I do? Because I want to find out. I may be doing something wrong there. But referring to your point about it not going anywhere, I mean, I would agree in terms of it's just a dead end by definition, and then add to that resources probably aren't going to support it, and many of these tech heads, they don't even consider the fact that the power outlet won't work if you know the economic system collapses, or if oil runs out. They just see there's a power outlet, right, and it's always going to be there, kind of thing. They don't think that far ahead. And that is the case with delusional systems of belief, that they're, and back to this isolation, that they're hermetically mm-hmm. sealed, and they're not allowed to refer to reality, of course, because they couldn't survive it. But, you know, as a counterpoint, Yeah, I read about transgender recently, and one of the reasons it interests me is that it intersects at very specific points very clearly with transhumanism, post-gender. As an ideology, this is one that is more mainstream than transhumanism, and it's certainly been very effective in terms of taking hold, as in people support it without understanding it. So I think, bringing back to a point you made very early on, like, most people are not going to read this Order of Nine Angles guy and go out and sacrifice a human being, although who knows with the coming generations, but just that they will take on that idea and give it some credence because of the context it's put in is going to colonize them and dissociate them further from their own inner sense of what's true. Then I think that that's more what we're looking at, that these ideas like transhumanism and transgenderism, even more so, I think is very powerful in that regard.
Yeah, precisely, because it's always this dichotomy and relation of core idea, which is completely extreme, and this idea that can be appropriated slowly by public. And transgenderism is transhumanism for me. That I don't see any real difference, because this is the idea that you can change your own nature at will. And that you can change it from the outside, because every technical act you do on yourself is in a way the act coming from outside. You'll need the surgeons to do work on you. You'll need the whole system of technology to turn you into exactly what you want to be, that cloud or something like that. And this makes you completely unfree, if you look at, I mean, metaphysically unfree. This cuts every possibility of freedom, which is a paradox, because they crave absolute freedom to recreate themselves, and by doing this they reject freedom absolutely. But for some reason they don't see it. I don't know why.
Yeah, and that's there's a real doublethink entailed there, particularly in terms of so much of this being promoted on the so-called left, because, as you're pointing out, the more that you subscribe to these kind of ideological promises of freedom, the more dependent you're becoming on the state and the establishment and the drugs and big pharma and military research and all the things that anyone with any, semblance of awareness knows is fucked. Is a really limited option and a really bad setup for human beings. So, and I guess you're pointing that out with the alt-right, that paradox there, that they're supposedly about getting back to nature. I mean, maybe not literally, but they want traditional values to be re-established and so on. And they have my sympathy there. Well, I wouldn't say I want traditional values because I think they predate tradition, but I wouldn't mind getting back to the Garden of Eden, I can understand that.
Oh, that would be good,
Yeah,
yeah.
but so they want that, whatever the equivalent is. But on the other hand, they're dependent on these, different technologies and so on and so forth that are completely at odds with the values that they're supposedly espousing. So, I mean, I don't like that. That seems to me in itself an example of what we're talking about in terms of being internally colonized, by bad ideas, that could leads to fragmentation, or that intensifies, fragmentation of the psyche or the soul or whatever word you would put on that, on a person's interior space. It gets compartmentalized.
Yes, we always return to this, to that idea. And I think this is something that is very very prevalent in our time, especially if you, as I said at the outset, if you are in the world of internet, because internet is a very good medium from promulgation of this sort of mental viruses. And I would agree with you. There are many Many versions of many forms of this phenomena, I would not go into it now. For instance, I already mentioned Dugin and so on, but you have networks of depravity on internet and the mental depravity, and that are slowly coming from the fringe towards the center. They are starting to influence mainstream society, and this is how it goes. So how will it end? Who knows?
Mm-hmm. So it was interesting the point you made about the internet. The more we identify with avatar, with our internet persona, which of course you and I have, uh-huh. We do our podcasts and our blogs and whatnot, the more susceptible we become to infiltration by internet uh-huh. spread memes, what have you. I guess because, uh-huh. I mean, you said it in a specific way, but I'm thinking also maybe it was what you said, that we become, we're made of the same stuff. It's like we start swimming in that water, then we start drinking it as well. We become constituted more and more sympathetic, I guess, mm-hmm. to the medium. This is why I do use Facebook, but I always use it with great reluctance, because Facebook is an internet within the internet, and it's very clear how it creates its own context for communication, and it transforms people's awareness, how they see themselves, and they become Facebooked.
I noticed Facebook is very interesting, because I noticed that there are some people who are not the same people when they are on the Facebook as they are in real life, because I know them in real life. And paradoxically enough, they can get much more intimate about themselves on Facebook than in real life. Mm. This is really, which is really a lunacy. I mean, for all the world to see their inner mental and emotional states, and they want to kind of brag about it. I think Facebook can drag these narcissistic tendencies in people to the fore.
Well, I think it, I mean, now you're saying that, I think it has to do with, like, we all want to be validated and feel that we have value, mm-hmm. and it's very scary if you share really personal stuff and it gets rejected. Well, Facebook accepts everything. Like, it's run by corporations who are taking that data and using it for their own corporate ends. So basically, your intimate stuff is going to be useful. It's the most mm-hmm. cynical and the most kind of debasing use of it, but at least you know that it's going to be liked. Literally, you'll get those clicks, mm-hmm. and you'll feel okay. So that's really, it's pretty grisly to think about, that people are, well, I guess, so dissociated, but also so desperate to feel like they're being received, and then Facebook. And so this brings about that question of, is it a conspiracy or is it happening? And, I've, for quite a time now, I've juxtaposed the word complicity with the word conspiracy, and I say, it's both, mm-hmm. but it's more about complicity, because we are complicit with the conspiracy. Therefore, there is a conspiracy, but it's not an us and them. There isn't a clear dividing line, because it only exists through our mm-hmm. complicity with it. So then it's so much deeper and wider than even, David Icke and his crew to ever really allow for.
I would agree with that. I think that this clear-cut idea of some kind of evil elites and good nature masses that's completely ahistorical and a counter to common sense. It's more about complicity with the lowest aspects of human nature than with anything else.
That gives rise to a system in which those who most embody their lowest nature have the most power and influence. So then you do end up, I think, with the machinery of conspiracy. But it's like mm-hmm. before that was us. I mean, obviously it had to come from somewhere. I guess this is where I have a problem with the devil, because I want to, and I think it is possible, to for the buck to stop with us. Like we can, I think we can trace all of the world's evil to ourselves and what we've done to ourselves, mm-hmm. without passing the buck on some metaphysical entity, even though we may have created a metaphysical entity. I think we have, but I still think before that was us.
Yeah, no, I don't think that we are the origin of this. I understand why you have this idea, but I don't think it really, not because it can explain. Maybe you can explain everything with that, but until the moment maybe you'll meet him in your life, God forbid.
Well, like I said, I mean, I have had that experience, and if I have it again, I will change my mind when I'm faced with it, but. You know, there are many things I've experienced that later I was able to see, oh, that was just me in some sense. That was an aspect mm-hmm. of me. So, I mean, mm-hmm. I keep it open. I try to keep that open, uh-huh. that question. Do you know René Girard?
I know who he is, but I never read him. He's a theology of sacrifice, is it not?
Violence and the Sacred, Mimetic Violence, the Scapegoat Mechanism. Very interesting. And he was a Catholic. He converted to Catholicism,
which might
interest uh-huh. you. And I think his work has been very useful to me, anyway, in terms of understanding, again, you know, what's deeper than conspiracy. Which in terms of like basic socio-psychological principles that can be applied. I see it as like a lever, and if you discover this lever within the human psyche and within human society, then it takes very little pressure on one end to create enormous change on the other, and so that does allow for things like social engineering that are not the way that we understand them in terms of conspiracy theory and people mapping it all out. It more relates to basic principles of human existence, which, if they are understood, can be applied, and then they cause enormous kind of effects. But anyway, mm-hmm. Girard is—I would recommend him if you are interested in those sorts of things, those kind of anthropological writings, because he's. I think he was quite a pioneer in terms of creating new models for understanding.
Yeah, I'll give him a look. Probably, I know about him, but never read him. I don't tend to read the modern theology, although he's more an anthropologist, I think. But I will probably put him on my schedule, which is rather overpopulated with books, because for the work I do, besides the work I do in real life, I really have to study a lot. So I started to make some kind of a system, to make a schedule for books, for documents, and so on, so I don't get lost in all of that. I cover a lot of subjects.
Yeah. Well, that was my impression. I was glad.
And that's not necessarily good.
Well, only you would know that, I guess. I mean, I found it quite difficult to get into what you were doing, but not that it hasn't been very long. But within the first week or two of reading it, I was finding it difficult to get in. To I don't know how to put it, but like there was just a lot of different angles that you're exploring. So I imagine probably true of what I do, that if somebody isn't familiar with it and they just come in midpoint, then it takes a while to orientate themselves. So it was useful. The podcast I happened to listen to last night were useful in that regard, because they were more they were less information based and more like you were talking more about your perspective on things, which is generally what interests me. I mean, I do like to get into information because I like the details, but it can take so long. Like, I wanted to ask you about what you think about socialism and Fabianism, because I grew up in a Fabian family. I didn't know it until recently, but I would like to get your take on that, but not today, because we've been on 2 hours already. But do you have a take on Fabianism?
Yes, well, Fabianism is also something on my schedule. I have to read the classics, Sidney Webb and others. I think Fabianism is a bit overemphasized in these conspiracy theory circles. I mean, it's a The philosophers I despise most in this world, like Bertrand Russell, were Fabians. But I think the Fabians are a bit demonized, but they are this brand of eugenics-oriented left, which is always sugarcoating a very sinister principles. But I would have to go into literature. I mean, I read Herbert George Wells, I read Russell, I read a lot of people who were Fabians, but never read what they said about Fabianist movement or party themselves. I do think it's a sinister political movement, but maybe. I think they don't know situation in England, but I think they still exist as a registered party.
Well, the Labour Party itself is Fabian, or at least it has been.
They infiltrated.
Created it. They didn't infiltrate it. They created it.
Created it. That's it.
Yeah. So, and that's, in terms of this, the archetypal thing that you talk about on your podcast about evil, that evil always wears a mask of good. They actually have the wolf in sheep's clothing.
That's fascinating. That heraldic image of theirs. Yes.
Yeah, and for me, it was very interesting and a bit confounding to find out what you just said, that the Fabian Society is the bugaboo of the right, because I hadn't even really heard of them, and I only started looking into them because I found out my grandfather was a founding Fabian in our county in Hull. And so I thought, oh, well, let's find out about the Fabian Society. And so at a certain point, while I was finding out my own stuff, I hit upon this other narrative, which is the one you're talking about, which it isn't necessarily false. I found the same with the Tavistock Institute. Like, if you read the literature about the Tavistock Institute out there, you'll probably, I don't know about you personally, but I anyway, would end up turning away, going, ah, can't be bothered. It's just, I'm not convinced. It's not well researched. It's not well documented. It just sounds to me like conspiracy theory, and you know, in the worst sense. And yet, again, with Tavistock, as with Fabian, the stuff I found was independent of all that stuff. And then I started to see, well, actually, that's really weird, because these badly written books that seem to be badly researched are written from an emotional perspective. They're not neutral. They're actually referring to these same facts that I'm uncovering. So then it starts to look like this is actually deliberate means to discredit information. You know, because certainly that's the effect. The effect is, like you said, well, I think that the Fabian influence has been exaggerated. Well, I mean, that still may be true. I'm not saying it isn't true. But I found out about the Fabian influence and how far-reaching it was by avoiding most of those sources and just following you know, other leads, and they just kept popping up. And so actually I could send you what I wrote, probably might be helpful to you, because it's I'll call it Yorkshire is basically that, and it doesn't refer to LaRouche or any of these dodgy sources.
That would be great. I would be very interested in this.
And I would be very interested to hear your take on it, because as I say, I don't often find researchers that I even want to talk to, much less, you know, collaborate with. So I'm glad that we hooked up as we did.
Likewise. And can you tell me, okay, we are already, I guess, overdue, but I would just ask you, maybe it's personal, you don't have to answer it. You said members of your family were Fabian Society, but did you consider them to be bad people?
Well,
privately?
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't, because I grew up with them, so, and it wasn't as though I had an overtly abusive childhood. I mean, as in, I don't remember overt examples of abuse. They were alcoholics, so it was highly dysfunctional.
That doesn't need to mean anything evil. That's just
no,
weakness.
It doesn't.
Okay.
So that question is a key one, and that's what I'm exploring in my own writings. Is that's why, you know, the question of evil and conspiracy and all the rest of it, where it arrived at my own doorstep. It really, and this did become, it's still the most compelling question. This thing you addressed, that evil almost always, and if it's successful, it always wears a mask of good. Well, and that to me is what is really wrong. I mean, that's the worst thing to me. It's not so much the badness that's being done. I can accept that at some level, but that it actually wears the mask of good, I think that in a way that's more destructive than even the thing that's being concealed, is the concealment. That's my own experience, and because it's reality distorting. It you know, it gives you a false map for the territory, and you're following this false map your whole life. And so that's my experience. I don't think my family were bad people, but I think that they would they were, well, I should say they, because I don't know how many of them, but my grandfather and probably some of my uncles were directly involved and complicit with horrific stuff, and probably including organized abuse even. I mean, I think that's even possible. They hid it. They had a social persona that was benevolent, socialist, cared for common people. I mean, I never believed that. I always thought they were hypocrites, but I didn't know how deep the hypocrisy went. I still don't.
Yeah, that's really terrible, yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, I would be much interested to read everything you can send my way about this subject. Okay.
You kind of sound like a little bit like Zizek Jr. I hope that's not an insult to you.
Well, it's not Zizek, he's crazy, but I think he's a benevolent guy.
I think
he's
so.
A Slovenian, I'm Croatian. We talk a different language, but he can speak Croatian also.
So I wasn't too far off the mark.
No, it's Europe. We were all, that was, I don't know if you remember that country, Yugoslavia.
I do remember, yeah, when it got split
Yugoslavia
up.
Broke up, and Slovenia is a westernmost republic. And Žižek and Laibach are two most famous of their exports. Okay, thank you for having me, and I'm signing out, and my warm regards to everybody listening to this.